Here's the thing you need to know about the topsy-turvy, mixed-up world that is the National Hockey League in 2016-2017, Jeff Merrick.
Oh, this sounds intriguing. Let me put on my thinking toque.
Yes, it's very intriguing. Did you know, FYI, DYK,
mm-hmm. Oh.
That there have been 19 instances this season over 93 games in which a team has overcome a multi-goal deficit to earn at least 1 point.
Huh.
And that the trailing team eventually won 15 of those 19 instances in overtime or whatever. And that through the first 2 weeks of the previous season, this only happened 8 times. So over double the multi-point or multi-goal deficit comebacks in this topsy-turvy mixed-up offensive season we have.
Well, it is. What's goal scoring up? Almost a full puck, or maybe more than a full puck per game,
somewhere in that neighborhood.
It's up, and you see with the lack of protecting leads. And so I know we're not even a dozen games deep into the season, but everyone's trying to put together their theories, and I'm no different, like everybody else. First of all, you hope the trend continues, makes the game better, makes the game more enjoyable. Before I go ahead,
I'm dying to know your theory.
Do you have
this,
a theory?
Because
I've got a few things. I don't think it's just one specific thing. I think it's a combination of a number of different things.
All of which,
you know, by the time we get to game 25, will probably be proven wrong. But let me hear what yours are first.
Remember in the perfect storm, how it was like three different storms all converging into a perfect George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg murdering storm. Spoiler.
Yep.
Here's how I think it works. One, all the goalies are hurt. Just every single one of them. They're all hurt. Nobody's healthy. Some of them are out of the lineup. Some of them are playing through injuries. They're all hurt. Except for Carey Price. He's fine.
No kidding. Jeez.
Number two, we've had a dramatic turnover from veteran players to younger players. And one of the things that you have preached on this very program since the start, since the dawn of time, since I threw a bone into the air and it turned into a spaceship.
A podcast.
That's right. 2001, a podcast. Yeah. One of the things that you've always preached is that young players make mistakes, and that mistakes are good for hockey.
Yes.
Because mistakes lead to goals.
Yes. Sloppy and hockey every day of the week.
And the third thing I'll say is that and this is completely controversial because I know that it flies in the face of so many things that are being said and bandied about now.
The pucks are smaller. Oh, no, okay.
It's a juiced puck.
The nets aren't bigger. The puck's smaller. Ooh, sneaky.
Yes, they put flubber in the puck. No, listen. We're like 6 games in the goddamn season. Like, nothing is going to hold. Everything's going to even out. Systems will be played. It'll be fine. I know that we're all there's. I got to be honest with you. Like, there's nothing more cringy than like doing a radio interview 6 or 7 games into the season and having it to be like, "Are the Oilers for real?" Like, I don't goddamn know. It's 6 games, 7 games into the season. Like,
what's wrong with the Calgary Flames? Greg Wyshynski, the editor of the Puck Daddy blog, will join us next to fill us in.
I mean, the only thing I know for sure this season is that Taylor Hall's going to score 40 goals.
Bajillion goals, yeah.
Yeah,
Corey Schneider's going to stop all the pucks. Taylor Hall's going to score all the goals, and New Jersey's going to make the playoffs, right? Wish that's the way it works, right?
Almost all the pucks. God damn, let Arizona back in that game last night.
That's bizarre, man. Arizona looked bad early. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's all the goalies are hurt. All the young players are super fast, but also mistake laden. See. Leafs, Maple, Toronto, and this is a trend that won't continue. But what say you?
I don't know if it'll continue or not. Who knows? I don't think that it does. I ultimately think that coaches and systems can overcome all the fun. But if it doesn't, this is what I would put forth as my theory. One, you've already touched on, what's the percentage of rookies in the NHL right now? Like, is this the largest number of rookies that have ever started a season in the league? It feels like it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're up and down every single roster. And there are tons of rookies. To that point, rookies lead to mistakes, which lead to lead changes, which lead to that, turnovers, which lead to goals.
To that point, too, like, not only rookies, but also, like, second-year guys, too. And I wonder if that's systemic of so many teams having gone into the tank, you know, and cleared out salary and gone super young. I mean, like, you look at this Leafs team.
I think a lot of it is just that the league is skewing younger. And with younger, you get, A, more creative, but, B, more mistakes. Like, when have we seen a 2-week span where more young players have done more things and been on more highlight packages and done more, A, jaw-dropping things both ways, you know, sublime and ridiculous.
I was thinking about that, and maybe the answer is 2005?
Well, that's when everyone was learning to play the game again. Like, yeah. That's the one that I crumple up and throw in the garbage. Sorry, Carolina Hurricanes.
But it was also, I've never seen a passing of the torch like this since 2005. I mean, like, the moment Sid Novy started, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now we have Magic and Bird. I'm not saying that's the case with Austin and Connor quite yet, but it kind of feels like it, you know?
The other thing that I'll point to, and this is more again on the rookies. No one in the NHL. Let's focus on Connor McDavid. Connor McDavid was born in 1997, so that group is now. I mean, if you're Connor McDavid's draft year, a second year player in the NHL. But if you go back to the '96s or even the '95s. When they started to play hockey, they didn't have to stop doing something and then start playing this version of the game. They've just grown up with this collection of rules, knowing this is the game. Like, if you were born in 90, if you were born in 1989, right? You grew up playing hockey a certain way. Then the 205 lockout happened in the NHL, well advanced to where you're at in your career, but there was a trickle-down effect. Because what happens in the NHL happens in minor hockey organizations all across North America. Those rule changes get absorbed by those organizations. Everybody essentially plays the same game that the NHL plays. For better or for worse, that's part of a discussion for a different day.
Right.
But those players had to stop playing a certain way and relearn the game. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Connor McDavid's draft group, if you look at the 97s, or if you look at the 96s, and clearly there's more 96s in the game than 97s, they've just grown up knowing... This isn't the new game. This is the game.
The game. Right, yeah.
This is what they've grown up with. This is how they've always played. And now we're starting to see those people, those kids, graduate into the NHL. So I would make the argument that up until now, we've never had a collection of players that have, to your earlier point about 2005, been able to grasp the rule changes. Because you've had to re-educate yourself. Your instincts have to change. And when those get built up over 18, 19, 20, 21 years, they are tough to break if you're a hockey player. Connor McDavid's group didn't have to break any instincts. They're still playing based on their same instincts that they started when they first played. Connor McDavid is, you know, he's a 97 birth date, right? So that collection of players, they've known that this is how you play hockey since the first time they played it in organized fashion, because a trickle down happened really fast. This is kind of one of the reasons why I don't want bigger nets, because that will trickle down to every single minor hockey organization, and that'll mess a lot of people up.
Yeah.
To say nothing of adding more to the bottom line for minor hockey organizations, but that's for another story. So that's one reason, right? So
the argument can be made that, you know, the same thing could happen for the goalies, is that over time they'll understand how to relearn their position. That's the big thing with the bigger nets for me, is that you're fundamentally changing the way someone plays their position, and it's going to take a generation to figure out how to do it. Like, because it's everything changes then. And I agree with you. I'm not a bigger nets guy. I'm actually a curved post guy. I always like the parentheses net. I'm in the minority.
Benoit Allaire's idea. The curved posts. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in the minority on that.
I just don't know how many that will lead to. I just don't know how many new goals that will lead to.
But we've also talked about, like, how, you know, it's not about the goals, it's about the flow of the game.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like, that's, it's much more important to figure out the rest of that for entertainment purposes than the cathartic, you know, puck goes over the line yeah. part of it. But anyway,
I'm more about less players than bigger nets.
Yeah. Oh, now you're talking. Now your point's well taken, and I think it also speaks to what the new NHL 2.0 rules emphasized, which is what these young players excel at, which is speed and skill. So yeah. when you design the game for a player like Connor or Matthews or friggin' Brian Rust, like you're clearly when these guys figure it out and they're young and they're super fast, yeah, of course they fit the template better than the older players do. You're right.
Yeah, like with all due respect to those players that came out of the lockout in 2005, those rules aren't for you. You happened to be there when they started, but those rules weren't for you. The effects of those rules weren't going to be felt for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it took even longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
We all knew it, I think, in the heart of hearts, that we all knew this was going to happen, with all due respect to those players. And that's why I kind of, not they want to devalue a cup win, but 2006, I don't know, like everything that happened that year.
Oh, it's a BS year. Nothing made sense at all.
Which was kind of cool. Which was kind of weird. Hey, Jonathan Chichu snapping him in. Hey, Carolina Hurricanes, Hartford Whalers winning your first Stanley Cup. It was kind of fun. It was bizarro world. And I'm into that. But the other thing is, too, I wonder how much of it now, and we're starting to see it in the last couple of summers specifically, how many players, forward specifically, are working on their craft.
What do you mean?
Well, goaltenders every summer work on their game. Players work out, right? Got to get my strength back. Oh, you know, I started with 105 flex at the beginning of the season. I'm down to an 85. I need all the help I can get by the end of the year because I've lost so much strength. And the first thing, you know, yeah, it's funny. I was having this conversation with Matt Nichol at the Combine in Buffalo. I said, what's the first thing you do with your guys when they come back from the season? And he said, well, first thing they don't do is they don't touch weights. The first thing their bodies need to do is heal and recover. Then we start to build the strength back up. You know what goalies do? They work on their games. They work on new ways to play, new ways to challenge shooters, new ways to hide net, new ways to move, new ways to stop shots, you know, new ways to think. The latest craze, of course, being head trajectory. How many players have done that? How many players said, you know what, I'm taking the summer to work on my release, to work on disguising the puck before I shoot?
Coaching's gotten
better. What's that?
The coaching's gotten better in the off season.
I think a lot of players now are going to more shooter coaches. Once upon a time, it was, you know, Joe Pavelski, Ryan Kessler, Curtis Lazaro would show up, and that was it at some of these goaltending camps. But I think a lot of players are realizing now that, you know, because we grew up, I don't know how what it was like around you, but where I grew up, there was a saying, right, that always stuck with everybody: you can't teach touch. You can't teach touch. You can either score goals, you can't. Oh, Mike Bossy was born with it. I think what we're realizing now is, well, that's probably part of it, but you're not just born with it. Scoring goals is a skill you can work on. And, you know, has it become a racket in the last couple of years? Well, go online and look at all the shooting schools. Of course it is. It's a way for someone to make a buck, and no more so than here in Canada, where there's individual skill set schools everywhere. But I think a lot more players are doing that now.
See, we really did grow up in different areas, because around me the saying was "snitches get stitches." So
snitches get stitches. Yeah, so we kind of had different upbringings, Greg.
Oh, no, totally,
a little
completely.
Bit. I got this, like, you know, growing up on Zamboni fumes, and you growing up on regular.
Yeah,
crime.
Well, you know, I grew up in a real, you know, Jersey neighborhood. Think
but
Tony
again,
Soprano shuffling out to get his newspaper in his bathroom.
To your earlier point. You know, we're not even 10 games in. I feel like such a fraud talking about trends 10 games
but
in.
But it's funny.
Because honestly, like, I was doing, you know, Western Canadian radio last week, like four or five different hits. And the question revolves around essentially two questions. Are the Oilers for real? And what's wrong with the Calgary Flames? And my real answer, I mean, you're on radio, so, you know, saying I don't know is, you know, we'll never get you invited back. But the real answer is, I don't know. We were only 5 games into the season. You know, are the Oilers this good? I don't know. Man, Montreal sure looked good the beginning of last season, didn't they? They sure look good again. Are they going to keep this up? I don't know. I have zero clue. And same as Calgary. And now look at Calgary. Back to back, Chicago, boop, St. Louis, boop. Okay. Ryan Elliott, right back to form. Happens.
The last thing I want to say about young players is I find it really interesting that in hockey, young players, the injection of young players into this league has led to, and I think we can both agree that it's led to a lot of this offensive explosion. It's a combination of their speed and their skill and the mistakes they made, they make. What's interesting about it is that I've been watching a lot of the NFL. It's been a horrible season. There's been a lot of unwatchable football. And one of the things that's happened in the NFL is because of the salary cap and because of just financial considerations, you're seeing a lot of veteran guys get squeezed out of jobs in favor of younger players. And the difference between the sports, I think, is that the NFL depends a lot on timing and execution. And if things go awry, plays just die. But I think in the NHL, if plays go awry, better, more offensive plays can happen because of it. And it's a weird thing to see, because I think both sports have seen a turnover and a getting away from the middle class or lower line role player.
Yeah.
But in the NFL's case, it's led to just Keystone Cops. And in the NHL's case, it's led to, oh, he scored a goal, then he made a turnover on his next shift, and then they scored a goal. And that's kind of how it goes when you go with younger players.
And doesn't this underscore as well, considering, and I think this trend continues, right? Like, I think we're, you know, the days of seeing a Jager in the game are done.
Oh,
that's
impossible. Sorry, well, I don't know, Merrick. The sun hasn't exploded yet, so I doubt that's the case with Jager.
But I mean, 30 years old, it's like, okay, Grandpa, let the kids play. I think I mentioned this on the last podcast. Doesn't this sort of, if you're a player, this is just from the player's point of view, knowing that your career is going to get shorter and shorter, like you will not have the 15-year career mm-hmm. anymore because it continues to get younger and younger. Doesn't this completely eliminate any idea of a player settling for a second contract? The minute you can, you should get paid. And it wouldn't surprise me to that end. It's funny, I talked to an agent about this a couple of days ago. It wouldn't surprise me if one of the things during the next lockout, there we go again, I said it. During the next lockout, one of the things the NHL goes after is a cementing of the second contract, i.e. a salary cap on the second contract.
Really? So you're saying...
I don't know. They're already triple capped. Why not make it quadruple while you're at it? A salary cap on the second deal.
Boy, I think it was Kiprios who said this, but over the weekend on Sportsnet. But that Aaron Ekblad contract is Exhibit A.
Oh, my God.
That's Exhibit A for what you're talking about.
There are so many teams around the NHL, whether it's... Because there's a couple on Florida. Whether it's the Aaron Ekblad deal or whether it's the Keith Yandle deal, there are so many teams. Funny, I was talking about this very issue last night, right before I went to bed with someone. There are so many teams around the NHL.
I hope it was your wife.
No, she was asleep. She's like, oh God, we just put the phone down. Yeah, I'm going to talk.
Honey.
Hey, honey, can you wake up? I'm concerned about the Florida Panthers and what they're doing to the salary structure in the NHL.
Jeff,
will you fucking go to bed?
Jeff, what is it? What's wrong? I was just thinking about Aaron Ekblad again.
But you know what? It's not just about Ekblad, I realized. It's also Keith Yandle, and I'm really confused. Can you wake up? I'm a little scared.
how could a man that young have such a splendid beard?
Look at that hair. Remember Vince Cellini, hon? Remember Vince Cellini? How perfect that hair was? That's Ekblad now. How could that happen? But there's a lot of teams that are like, oh, wow, thanks, Florida Panthers, for getting caved in on those contracts. With one player in Aaron Ekblad who had zero leverage. I mean, really, it's the second deal. Yeah. And why is it that the Tampa Bay Lightning can, you know, get that Florida discount because you're not paying state tax, while meanwhile the Florida Panthers are paying up the wazoo for their players?
Yeah.
The Yandle deal, and Yandle's fascinating as well because it almost seems as if you know, they've realized that playing him 5-on-5 against top competition is not the way to go for Keith Yandle, but you're paying him as if he's a player that needs to go up against top competition.
Right.
And so that salary, based on that skill set, is out of whack. And so is the Aaron Ekblad deal. Right? Like, all those players. Now, remember when Morgan Riley signed and you said to yourself, oh man, Bob Murray, you know, better send a bouquet to Lou Lamoriello for keeping that Morgan Riley deal up, you know, between $5 and $5.5 million, because that's the Hampus Lindholm deal. Mm-hmm. And ditto for Tim Murray with Ristolainen, and then go right down the list of those, you know, the second contract defensemen around the NHL, former first rounders. But no, and then comes Florida, who can sell a lower salary based on no state tax, but instead hand Ekblad that deal. And here's the one that's got to burn the NHL. If I'm the NHL and this goes through Central Registry, I'm smacking my head. You see what Ekblad has for his bonus structure during the lockout? You see the poison pill in the contract?
What was it?
He's got lockout insurance of $4 million. Hmm. During the lockout, Aaron, and that's the one thing that just kills the NHL. They hate it that players will get paid during, because that, you know, takes away some of their strength, one of their pressure points. Oh, these guys aren't making money. We can squeeze them for a little bit more. Well, Aaron Ekblad is going to be fine, thank you very much, during the lockout. Like, honestly, yeah. the Orr group, that was a Picasso by the Orr group. It was like one of their, now McDavid's is going to be another one. But if you look at signature contracts that the Orr group should have in their office on the wall as new potential new clients come in, like, look what we were able to do for Aaron Ekblad. Oh, is this his free agent contract? No, this is his second contract. What? That's right. Now, let me tell you what Orr group can do for you, potential new clients.
Yeah.
Why can Tampa sell it, but Florida can't? It's the same state. How come Tampa can get guys to come in and understand that you will make the equivalent money here by living in Florida than you would elsewhere? Meanwhile, you know, Florida signing contracts like Sunrise might as well be in Connecticut.
Well, listen, I mean, in fairness, like, Tampa used to hand out this kind of contract, and that's why eventually they had to put a gun to Dan Boyle's head and said, you're going to be a Shark.
By Vanilla Cavalier.
Yeah, like, they used to hand out these contracts all the time in Tampa, but the difference is, well, that was the result of being a victim of their success, and right now their success is having a different effect on their salary structure, which is that everybody's falling into line. And the idea is, well, you need to take this amount of money if you want to keep this thing going. It's an interesting study in contrast. Now, granted, the difference also was the salary cap came into play, which is why all those contracts that were signed around their cup in 2004 all of a sudden became, you know, hindrances. And everybody kind of knows what they have to make here in order to keep the team together. But it's an interesting difference in what the forces of winning can do to a team and their salary structure. Now, in Florida's case, they don't have proof of concept yet. In Florida's case, Aaron Ekblad is signing on the dotted line on the promise that they're going to become that kind of team.
Yep.
And they also, you know, they overpaid Yandle to come there. They overpaid Ekblad to stay there.
I do like the Demers signing, though. I'm just dumping on the Florida Panthers. I do like the Demers deal.
Oh yeah, I mean, they've got some good, decent contracts on the books too. I think Barkov at 5'9" is right around where he probably should be, even though he's young too. But yeah, it's interesting to see. And the Ekblad deal ultimately is gonna be the type of contract that will lead to what you were talking about before, which started this whole thing, which is the idea that they might try to have a second cap on second contracts. Which,
like, he goes from 9.25 to 7.5.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, July 1st cannot come fast enough for Aaron Ekblad. Like, let's just get the season over with.
Right.
So I can start getting paid.
And start getting real money. But would the players ever go for that, though? I mean, I know that's kind of like, that's like saying, oh yeah, well, they won't, it won't matter. I mean, they don't have any leverage.
Well, the players, this is Jeff 2003, the players will never go for a salary cap. Come on. They fought it off before. They'll fight it off again. Come on, Greg Wyshynski. Move on. Next topic. Well, you know, it's,
But the thing is, there are certain things that you believe they'll fight for, right? Having young players get money is not one of them.
But here's the thing. They're But that's a player that's got 3 years of union service. Okay, that's where it's different. Like, I'm with you. Like, they always throw the rookies under the bus.
They always
every labor negotiation, they throw the rookies under the bus. Right? Double, triple salary cap. Yeah, throw it on them. Bonuses capped, salary capped. You have the team cap. They all have to fit under as well. They have no problem throwing those guys under the bus because they haven't skated one single shift in the NHL yet. So I get that. I understand that. But now we're talking about players that have been in the league for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And those are those guys that are sitting with them at the negotiations, at those NHL Players Associations meetings. And what they don't want to do is turn player against player in those meetings. Because if you start to acquiesce to that second cap, and you have, like, let's say you're Connor McDavid's, let's say there's a lockout right now, or at the end of the season, and you're Connor McDavid's second-year player, and you are poised for a bajillion dollars from the Edmonton Oilers. And someone, maybe someone from your own team who's been in the, you know, players union for a long time, like Milan Lucic, stands up and says, well, you know what? If it'll give us lower free agency, let's cap the second contract. And you're Connor McDavid, you go, huh? Like, all of a sudden, you're Scooby-Doo. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. Pump the brakes, pump the brakes, pump the brakes here. What are we talking about here? I mean, yeah. I've paid into the union. I'm a part of the union. Yeah, I'm a big part of the marketing of the NHL and the Players Association. I'm not the guy that gets thrown under the bus. The guy that gets thrown under the bus is going to be Nolan Patrick, is going to be Gabe Vilardi, is going to be Timothy Liljegren, is going to be one of these types of players. Not me. Mm-hmm. I'm in the NHL. Those are the guys that they'll still fight for. Rookies, not in the league. Yeah, whatever. Cap them even more. We don't care. Just give us some cookies at the other end.
It's going to be fascinating to see who steps up. Like, because the next one's going to be like 2020, right? The next lockout or 21?
There's a potential. There's a potential for them to reopen it, but it looks like 22.
All right, so 22. So 2022, all right, guys like Getzlaff are 37, okay? Guys like Sid are like 34, 35. So I wonder who ends up being the Trevor Lindens and the Matthew Schneiders and whatever in this next lockout. Like, I wonder who ends up being the guys at the table for the NHLPA in the next lockout. Will it be a guy like Connor?
It's never really been the superstar.
And it's never been. Doesn't he seem the type, though? Honestly.
Connor, jeez.
There are two kinds of business savvy. There's the PK Subban business savvy, which is, I'm gonna put on this flashy jacket and make my dough. And then I think Connor is really business savvy. I think he is a guy who's been in the industry, as it were, since he was a toddler. And I think he gets that part of the game a little bit more than a lot of young stars do.
I've never seen it. I know what you mean. He is all business. Like, mm-hmm. Remember the first time I went over to the McDavid's to interview Connor and talk to Brian, his father. And it was, I think, the second or third time I'd ever talked to McDavid. I came away with, like, how serious this kid is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, how extreme, like, it is insane how serious he takes his career. But I don't know that I've ever, because that's a real rock the boat position.
Okay? So you're
like,
saying
that's like Ron Hainsey territory.
You're saying that he might be just hockey serious. Like, he's the kind of guy that might urge his friends to maybe settle things so he can get back on the ice where it belongs. That kind of guy.
I don't know about that. I just don't know that McDavid has a personality to take a strong public position. That's a tough one. Although it would be great. I've always maintained that for the National Hockey League Players Association, one of the best things they could have ever done, and I guess you can't do it now with Wayne, but one of the best things you could ever do is during a lockout is hire someone like Wayne Gretzky, mm-hmm. as your spokesperson, as your public face of your negotiations.
Yeah, so it's absolutely. Not Donald.
That way you can't have anyone from the NHL side say, well, you guys don't understand hockey. Did you just say that Wayne Gretzky doesn't understand hockey? Could you imagine the headlines? Could you
yeah,
imagine
and
how
actually,
sensitive the NHL would have to be in their public message, knowing that the face of the Players Association was Wayne Gretzky?
Yeah, and if nothing else, Wayne Gretzky's shown that he's the one guy in the NHL that can get the NHL on their knees handing him money. He's pretty much shown that in the last year, hasn't he?
Well, you know what? It is, and that's one of the reasons I always maintain this. Like, this is one of the reasons why, if you're the National Hockey League, it's important to have your stars on side, even just for a simple thing like that.
Yeah,
like, you needed to have Wayne Gretzky in the mix after, you know, the Phoenix Coyotes debacle. You needed to get him. How many times do we say on this podcast, just find a way to pay that man.
Yeah.
Make it good, make it even, and get Wayne Gretzky in the mix.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do for a centennial? Like Mike Gartner is your guy? Come on. You need Gretzky.
Yeah, Gart scored a lot of goals, too, though.
It's a centennial. It's a big deal.
It's a little bit big.
All right, listen. Winnipeg held their outdoor game in between shows for me and you. Did it make a blip on your radar? I was stunned by how little attention was paid to this game, even with Connor in the game.
It did move a little bit here in Canada. I just think it was too early in the season. I don't think the season. Because I think it's such a profoundly different event that right now everyone is still in the middle. Because let's not forget, this is in the middle. This is at the beginning of the season. You're coming off an Austin Matthews performance in Ottawa, a Patrick Laine performance in Winnipeg. Like, there's still a lot of excitement. The outdoor games to me are that sort of jolt after a couple of seasons when a malaise sets in, when the season settles and you're into the hamster wheel of the season. Then you need a little something to juice it. I think the big problem with this one is it just came too early, because everyone's still excited about Matthews and McDavid and Patrick Laine. Like, there's still a lot of reasons to be excited about hockey. And then this thing comes along. It's like, whoa. We don't need that yet. You know, we're still buzzing and charged off the beginning of the season, which has been fantastic.
No traditional buildup towards it. It was
just
kind of like came out. You're right. It kind of came out of nowhere. It's like, wait, this is here already? It's like Halloween.
Yeah, I know. Although I will say one thing, man. Man, I love watching those alumni games.
Oh, with Timu? It was awesome. Oh, my God. That's the best.
Never mind Timu. Has Esa Tikkanen slept a night since he retired? Those are the darkest circles I've ever seen under any man's eyes.
Well,
like,
I'd like
darker circles than, like, outfielders with the Oakland A's. Okay?
I would love to believe that his life has been spent in sort of Edgar Allan Poe-like existence. Where all of the people he harassed and harangued and speared and whatever
have just kept him up, or bugging him like nonstop.
Yeah, he's visited
Please
by a different
let me
ghost.
Sleep.
He's
let me
visited,
sleep.
He visited by a different ghost every night.
Essa, you punched me in the back of the head when I looked at Gretzky the wrong way.
Is that the ghost? Is that the ghost of Joel Otto coming to haunt me now? Oh no! There's the next Twitter feed, by the way, the ghost of Joel Otto.
But Edmonton wins that game, and let's get back to them for a second. 5-1 on the season, 10 points. The only team in the Pacific Division, by the way, with a plus goal differential, plus 7. It was a matter of time before the McDavid effect took hold and this team made the leap. I'm still not convinced totally it's this season. I'm the one who said I think they were going to be a bubble team.
Yeah.
But the way that division looks right now and the way they're playing, it kind of seems like they're a playoff team this year, doesn't it?
It's a 6-game stretch. Talk to me after 15.
The only
and
thing
I'm,
that
and
gets...
I'm happy, like, as a Rogers employee, if Edmonton continues, you know, to do this, to go, like, and same as Vancouver. You know, happy for them to be a playoff team as well after what happened around our shop last year with no Canadian teams making the playoffs. But I'm with you. Like, I don't think that Edmonton is as good as we've seen off the start. And outside of the two games, Chicago and St. Louis, I don't think the Calgary's as bad.
The two things that give me pause about Edmonton are, what if Connor doesn't play 82, and when adversity hits, let's see what the locker room looks like. That's the thing. That's the one fascinating thing about this Edmonton team is that with McDavid there as a sophomore, and he's not been there through all of the marinating and all of the toxic waste that's been the Edmonton Oilers for the last several years, and with Lucic now in the room, have you changed the complexion enough where when adversity hits, it's not going to be you know, Taylor Hall and Jordan Eberle in the corner of the locker room sighing deeply and wondering where they're going to get a beer that night. Like, have you changed the complexion enough where that's not going to be a malaise that hits the team when adversity hits?
McDavid went through that in junior, his first year with the Erie Otters. They were abysmal. I mean, they only won a handful of games. And, you know, that was his exceptional year into the OHL. So it's not as if he's only known winning his entire life. Like, look at a player like Kiefer Bellows. This is why I always wonder about players that have had so much success. Kiefer Bellows last year, talked to him at the draft, and I read somewhere that outside of last year, he's at the end of the season, he's always won a championship. Always. And I'm like, that's gotta be wrong. Like that just sounds, you know, bizarre. After, you know, everywhere that he's gone, now he's playing at BU, but everywhere that he's gone, he's won a championship at the end of the season. And I asked him about that. Islanders grabbed him 19th. I said, is that true? He goes, yeah, end of every year, I've always won a championship. Yeah. This is the first year that I didn't. Like, what? So you always wonder about, in a bizarre kind of way, players that have had too much success, because how do you handle it when it does go sideways? And to your point, you always wonder about the players that have known nothing but failure. And what happens to them?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, players that have too much success kind of scare me, even though in theory they should be Tavesian and quote unquote know how to win, right? Coaches who win fascinate me. Like I was talking to one GM the other day about Bednar and the idea that, like, he comes to Colorado having won everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the guy tells me, he's like, you have to pay attention to that. Like, it, no matter what you think about the guy with no NHL experience and, you know, what is the system going to look like in the pros, that whole thing, like, you have to perk up and pay attention to the idea that this guy just seems to win on every level. And Cooper's another guy like that. Cooper's another guy that, like, won in everywhere he went before he came to Tampa. There are just guys that the coaching pedigree of winning is something you have to pay attention to, but the winning pedigree of a player, to me, I agree with you. I think for a guy who's won at every level and then he goes into a situation, he's drafted in the top 10, he goes to a situation, all of a sudden he's getting his ass kicked every night. That's a tough place to be. And a lot of those Edmonton kids were in that boat for the last several seasons.
You look at the junior careers of Connor McDavid, no OHL championship, no Memorial Cup, and you look at Milan Lucic, who won WHL championship and a Memorial Cup with the Vancouver Giants. So listen, there's no one formula, there's no one sort of, okay, we need this type of player and boom, you put them on your team and this is the recipe for success and it's going to happen. There's no one simple formula for coaches, for general managers, just like there's not one way to construct the team. Because at the end of it, you know what we're talking about here, Greg?
What are we talking about?
We're talking about luck.
No,
a whole ton of luck.
I've got a giant binder of analytics here that tell me that luck
There are certain ways you can increase your percentages of being a lucky. There are a lot of ways you can warm yourself up to luck. Hey, luck, let me buy you a drink. Come on, let me tell you how. See this Corsi stat here? Let me buy you a shot. Two shots, bartender. There's ways you can improve your odds, certainly. We're still dealing with a lot of luck here.
We're still dealing with a frozen rubber thing on ice. And people that are on knives chasing it.
1/8-inch blade of steel.
All right, real quick before we get to some listener mail. Detroit's an interesting team. And
Helm Vanek Nyquist.
And Howard and Mrazek right now. And we had somebody on Twitter asking us if we think that we want to revise our Detroit pick.
No.
That they're going to miss the playoffs. Oh, this is no. Mr. Jones. Even after a small sample, do you guys still think the Red Wings are going to miss the playoffs? I do.
Yeah.
Because
handful of games, guys.
Montreal and Tampa are in, and I still think Florida's in, and I think that once Boston gets past this goaltending hell that they're in.
Hang on. Who's playing defense for Boston then? Did I miss that? Did they get some new defensemen?
Well, eventually it'll be Cam Fowler. But the thing is
and Jacob Trouba. Okay, gotcha.
Right, exactly. But I mean, listen, I've been really impressed. I saw Detroit here in New York against the Rangers. I was blown away by the way Howard played. That was great for him. I still think essentially right now they've been pretty much a one-line team with that Nyquist, Vanek line. And Larkin's been good. But I think...
I don't think
they're a playoff team. And by the way, if you're going to make the argument that the Boston's blue line is a giant pile of horse shit...
I know Detroit. Detroit's no great shakes either. I don't disagree. And goaltending is a great eraser, right? You can either add with the lead or erase with the rubber. And I'm with you on Detroit, on the blue line. And that, I think, is going to be one of their undoings. If/when their goaltending comes back down to earth.
The other team I wanted to ask you about, it, are you a little worried about Nashville? Two and three off the hop? No.
I mean, I'm concerned about... Nah, I shouldn't even say concerned. It's too early. I wonder about Philip Forsberg. Who hasn't had a great start by any stretch? But no, I don't worry about Nashville. Dude, come on. A little bit of food poisoning. Five guys go down. Look, they just smoked the Penguins 5-1. It'd be fine.
You worry about the...
They're my cup pick.
You worried about Philly at all?
Am I worried about Philly?
I found it interesting, by the way.
In what sense?
I think Elliot mentioned this. That the Kings kick the tires on Steve Mason?
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't surprise me.
I just feel like Philly's got a nice thing going on goaltending-wise there, and I don't understand why they would want to get rid of either of those guys.
With Mason and Neuvirth?
Yeah, unless it's
Philly's going to be a fun team. Man, Travis Konecny's another fun player to watch. Voracek, unlike last year, has started off the season great. When last year, if there's one player that could not adapt to the Dave Hakstol style of play, it was Voracek. I don't know that I've ever seen a player in one half of a season hit the net or miss the net more times than Jacob Voracek. Remember last year, every time the puck was on his stick, I know everyone always blasted Phaneuf for not being able to find the net. Dion, the net hasn't moved in 100 years. It's in the exact same place and it hasn't budged. And Voracek was the same way. Provorov, although there've been some moments where he's had some growing pains, he's a rookie defenseman. He's done some things out there that, I mean, he made this flip pass to Matt Reed in the Carolina game that was one of the quietly most beautiful things I've seen all season long. Mm-hmm. Spinning off checks, getting the puck out, getting zone on his own and going down deep as a rookie. That's another thing we didn't talk about with these. Like, the rookies come into the NHL now, and we're seeing this with Provorov. They come in fearless and they don't defer to vets. Like, they don't have that reverential, oh, it's a 2-on-1. I better figure out a way how I can pass this puck. They'll look at it and say, there's no pass there. I'm shooting. Where once upon a time, you would do whatever it effing took to get that pass over.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're a defenseman, you're not taking the puck down low on a zone entry. Now, guys are doing it. I think Philly's going to be a fun team. Philly's, like, already, I love watching Philadelphia Flyers games. I really do.
Yeah, I've talked about how much it pains me that I do as a Dallas
fan.
Bud. Real quick, three quick questions from the listeners. Glenn, you got a punt.
Shoot.
Garnet Leopard wants to know, how long until the Leafs give up on Anderson?
How about yesterday when he's asked if he's being asked to play a different system, and he said, I don't want to comment on that?
Yeah, there's definitely a learning curve there for him.
We talked about this on the last podcast, about it's a different style of Frederick Anderson, where Babcock likes his goaltenders to challenge shooters. Like, I'm not making this up. Look at Jimmy Howard, look at Jonathan Bernier, look at James Reimer, and now look at Frederick Anderson. Uh-huh. The way Freddie Anderson now is playing with the Maple Leafs is different than how he played with Anaheim.
And then, of course, the guy on Saturday said he was terrible.
Who?
Man, Mike
Babcock. The
guy Babcock
on Saturday.
Who?
Mike Babcock was not into that conversation at all. He was really not picking up what Kenny was putting down. He really did not want any. And then what happens? Anderson goes and lays an egg against Tampa.
I know.
If you're Don Cherry and you're watching that game, you're just like licking your chin. Saturday can't come fast enough. Just, like, okay,
you got a knife and a fork in your hand. Like, you got a prime rib in front of you, ready to carve it up.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. Eamon Fricker wants to know, who's having a bigger impact on Montreal's success, Price Weber or Noah Subban?
Price.
I would agree with that.
Price, and Carey Price.
Also,
hang on. Shea Weber's shooting percentage is not going to stay at 14%.
No, it's not.
Okay. the answer to Montreal is Carey Price, and they're giving up more chances than last year Montreal is. So you can make the argument that in some respects they're not playing as well as they were last year. But what's the difference? Yeah. Oh yeah, they have the goaler back.
Shea's got two really good years left in him. I think he's going to be fine this year. I think the two things that we're seeing from the start of the season is that the analytics community buried Weber to build up Subban, and Weber's not nearly as bad as he's been made out to be. And the analytics community buried the Rangers before they were ready to die. Like, they're a better team than people gave them credit for. Now all of a sudden people are perking up. They're like, wow, look how well the Rangers are playing. Well, like, well, they're still a good team. They're not garbage yet.
The analytics community that now recognizes the Merrick percentage as a goaltending analytic on Corsica hockey.
What in the hell are you talking about?
You need to go to your Corsica hockey and go to the goaltending stats and look at the far right column from a conversation that you and I think it was part when Rob Volman was on. Manuel Perry put it on Corsica hockey, the Merrick percentage.
All right.
I now have an analytic named after me, Greg.
Thanks,
Manny.
This is probably more exciting than when Lou Gehrig had Lou Gehrig's disease named after him.
The Merrick percentage. Oh, hang on. What were we talking about, though? Look, the one thing that does concern me about Montreal is how quickly they've gotten away from Shea Weber and Nathan Beaulieu as a pair. Like, you wonder if this is going to be Alex Galchenyuk. He's a winger. He's a center all over again. Like, the one thing they need to do is use Shea Weber to help make a number of other defensemen. Like, the one thing that Weber did so great in Nashville is he played heavy minutes with inferior quality defenders, and he made them all better. Right? He made all of them better. He was also
propped up by some pretty good defensemen, too, in Suter and Josie.
Towards the end with Roman Josi, but him and Suter were real good together, but I mean, he logged huge minutes and helped out younger defensemen. And already they've gone away. Like, you just look at the game, we just mentioned Philadelphia, the game against Philadelphia. Was it one period with Nathan Beaulieu and then away from it, and by the end it's just a steady diet of Shea Weber and Alexi Emelin playing together? Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute here. You have Shea Weber, use him to help make, like, if you want Nathan Beaulieu to be that guy, to be the next defenseman for the Montreal Canadiens, you can't. I mean, you have to do it. I'm sorry. Like, don't. I mean, it's the same thing as Galchenyuk. He is a centerman. You're gonna have to just put up with some bad shifts while he learns how to play center at the NHL level.
Yeah.
As opposed to being dragged, kicking, and screaming into it while you play David Desharnais higher than him.
Eamon also wants to know your favorite fish and sushi. I would say mine is probably. I mean, I guess I would probably say salmon.
As a vegan, I don't eat the fish anymore. But when I did, and this might be the only one thing that I would ever go back for. Like, if you said, hey, Merrick, you're going back for one thing and one thing only, it ain't steak, which is a default for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It ain't chicken. It is hamachi, yellowtail.
I would say the thing I like the most is probably unagi, the eel, but that's because of that sauce they put on there. Because if you know,
I never got into eel.
I'm a condiment
down
boy.
With sushi.
Real quick, Jackie Clinic has a weird one. We always like the weird questions. Why, when a goalie is penalized, is he not required to sit in the box? I think he sits. His coach decides to either put in the backup goalie or play empty net and add a skater. Thoughts? Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Have a lot of cold goaltenders coming in. I'm trying to think of what the genesis of that was, and why the goaltenders used to serve their own penalties.
Did they used to serve their own penalties?
And just bring in replacements.
Is that how it used to be?
No, I don't think they ever did.
Let me get back.
Yeah, exactly. Point and cover point. Let me get back to you on that one. But why wouldn't they serve that? Well, I mean, you've only got, you know, you can bring in a player. You can substitute a player, and you're not bringing in a cold hockey player. I mean, I wonder how much of that is just a function of injuries. Of injuries, because you don't want a cold player coming in to stand in there while guys wire 100-hour slap shots for 2 minutes at you. I mean, I have no problem with the player replacement. I haven't seen it be an issue yet.
I would have a problem with it only because, much like every other thing in this league, that involves taking a player off the ice, players would skate up and punch goalies in the face. And then the goalie would punch back, and then they'd get matching minors, and you take the goalie off for 2 minutes.
Is that kind of way that now with concussion spotters, you encourage players to hit each other in the head more because you know that a spotter may take him off the ice?
Oh, damn. I ain't willing to go there yet. But that's... It's a conversation for another day.
I hope we're not going to see it. But if you are just like, you know, win at all costs and winning is the only thing. If you know that someone thousands of miles away can take the best player off the ice because you hit him in the noggin.
Can we just have an unspoken vow to not do that? Because ultimately the concussion spotting thing is probably a good thing for hockey, and we won't end up with losing his mind and attacking an official. But like, if it goes to that direction, I feel like maybe they won't do it anymore.
Listen, there has never been, and this is going to pain the old timers to hear it, but it's true. There has never been more honor amongst hockey players than right now. There has never been more respect in the game than right now. Whenever an old-timer tells you these kids don't respect each other anymore in the hockey game like we used to, call that person a liar and direct them to the numerous examples on this fancy bit of technology called YouTube, where it demonstrates that half of the league should have been arrested at various points in NHL history. This game now has more respect, period. And to your point, Greg, I would like to think that amongst, and there's a number of reasons for that, rise of the players' union, a lot of players moving teams, players training together, agency almost more important than team, a lot of reasons for it. But I would like to think that we're at the point now where that isn't a tactic, like, hey, let's play the concussion spotter game, sacrifice one player to ring someone up around the ears, and we'll get their best player off the ice. But I'll tell you what, there was an era in the NHL. Like, let's say you had concussion spotters in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Let's say the concussion spotter was a thing in 1975. Would you put it past the Philadelphia Flyers to get an extra elbow up on Guy Lafleur? No. I wouldn't.
No.
Or the Boston Bruins to get an extra elbow up on, I don't know, take your pick, Brian Trotche? I wouldn't. Just knowing that might take him out of the game.
I guess, I
think it would be a real ethical dilemma for a hockey player. But back then, no dilemma. Just do it.
But I think the ethical dilemma speaks to both sides, though, which is that I wouldn't also put it past the team to turn around and rush a guy right back out rather than putting him through the...
Oh, in 75? Oh, yeah.
And today. I mean, for God's sakes, I don't think the full protocol is the full protocol for all players. That's all I'm saying.
I don't have a comment for that because I don't know if that's true or not. I know the default for a lot of coaches is he's fine, right? No, just tell me he's fine so I can put him back on the ice.
Right. Now that might change when you're facing a lawsuit, you know.
Yeah.
And basically the only smoking guns they have in the lawsuit are the malpractice of underlings. So maybe that changes things. But I still think that some players miraculously return to the game faster than others in this league. All right, well, we're ending on a high note.
Yeah, on that note.
The dirty, injurious brain scrambling that occurs in order to win in this league.
We're a cheery bunch. Glad to start your day off on a little note of positivity.
a little bit of coffee and burnt toast and concussion talk here on MVSW.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Fun. Positive. Start your day with a smile.
All right, you lovely people. We will talk to you next time. Thanks to producer Sam for getting up so early. He kicked off his Juan Batista jammies, or Jose Batista jammies.
Juan Batista.
Yeah, Juan Batista.
So like right, think about Juan it. Batista. It's a new kind of coffee that Greg's drinking.
And he got into the office early and did the thing.
Unlike me and Greg, who just wandered into our either living room/basement to do a podcast, poor Sam had to get up and drag his ass to the fan to do
You know
this.
It's early when
Sam is the first star. Sam McKee, follow that man on Twitter.
You know it's early when I get up before my dog does. Usually my
dog. Yeah, I haven't heard Sneakers a lot. Even Sneakers is like, what the fuck are you doing? Roll up to bed.
Dark
What's wrong with you?
Condolences to the Cubs for game one, although I think they'll be fine. They'll be all right.
Cubs care about the World's game one. Yeah, I do, because I want the Cubs to win.
Yeah. I've been saying the world split up into two types of people. People who want the Cubs to win, and then on the other side, Cleveland fans and fans of abject misery that just want to see the Cubs continue to be this.
I don't. I want it to be over. Just want some of these. Like, you think of how many people have died never seeing their baseball team win. Just let them have it.
I could comprehend the Red Sox winning because eventually they had to get one over on like the Yankees.
Yeah.
I got to be honest, I can't comprehend a world in which the Cubs won the World Series in my lifetime. It's a weird feeling.
Deal with it, buddy. New world. Go Cubs.
Of course, I can't handle the Leafs winning either now I think about it.
Don't worry about it. You seen the goaltending?
Yeah, you won't have to worry about that, Wish.
Whatever. Austin Matthews, Willie Nylander, top five in scoring. Don't mean squat, bud. Don't mean squat.
All right, everybody. We will talk to you down the line. And thanks for listening. I was waiting for the outro music, but
this is it. It's playing. You just can't hear it in your ears? All right, there it is.
Oh, no, I couldn't hear it at all.
Yeah, it's going. It's great.
Oh, all right.
Little pleasure skating music. Here we go.
There it is. All right. Hi, everybody.
First time here. Sorry, Wish.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.